It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, we are your public radio station, broadcasting from beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is currently 53 degrees. Out at the airport, they are showing wind speeds from the southeast at 10 miles per hour, 74% humidity, and they are up to 10 miles of visibility. Coming up on the Midday Report, more communities are being added to GCI's Aleutian Fiber Project, including three villages in the Kodiak Archipelago. Hooper Bay has seen its dunes taken away by the recent storm. And a landslide in downtown Juneau has destroyed one home and left some people potentially homeless. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hurricane Ian's made landfall in Florida. It is expected to unleash catastrophic conditions that will affect the majority of the state. The storm is a powerful Category 4, coming ashore with top sustained winds of 150 miles per hour. It brings life-threatening storm surge. Some areas could receive as much as 2 feet of rain as the storm slows. Pastor Trent Morgan with the Assembly Church in Sebring, a town located in the center of Florida, says he's worried the power outages, which began this morning in some parts, will last for days and severely impact some of the most vulnerable residents who don't have backup generators or other assistance.
Down here, there's a lot of people who do not have city water, so they're on wells. So if they lose power, then they don't have access to water. That's a big concern, especially for the elderly that live out of the city limits.
Ian made landfall at Cayo Costa, the same spot where Hurricane Charley came ashore in 2004, also as a Cat 4 storm. President Biden is urging Florida residents to heed the warnings of local officials. NPR's Frank Ordonez reports Biden also says oil and gas companies should not use the storm as a reason to hike gas prices.
Speaking at a hunger summit, President Biden said he had spoken with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis about preparations for the hurricane.
And my message has been absolutely clear, is that we are on the alert and in action. We've approved every request Florida has made.
He also warned oil and gas executives to not raise prices at the pump, saying the storm should only have a small and temporary impact on production.
Do not. Let me repeat, do not use this as an excuse to raise gasoline prices or gouge the American people.
He said America is watching. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
Moscow-backed leaders of 4 Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine are taking steps to formally join the Russian Federation. We have the latest from NPR's Jason Bobian.
The Kremlin-backed leaders of the separatist regions of Luhansk and Donetsk say they're traveling to Moscow to negotiate formally becoming part of the Russian Federation. Russian-installed officials in occupied parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson also claim the ballot results give them the mandate to join Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky denounced the referendums as illegal and said annexation of any part of Ukraine would eliminate the possibility of peace talks with Moscow. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the West will never recognize these votes. Russian Foreign Ministry, meanwhile, issued a statement saying the referendums were held in full accordance with the law. Jason Bobien, NPR News, Kryvyi Rih, Ukraine.
This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Six more communities are being added to the telecommunications company's GCI's Aleutian Fiber Project. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports the massive undertaking is now slated to bring high-speed internet to a dozen communities along the Alaska Peninsula, including three villages in the Kodiak Archipelago.
GCI announced last week that the native village of Port Lyons on Kodiak Island was awarded a nearly $30 million grant to hook into 800 miles of subsea fiber the company is currently laying on the ocean floor. The funding also secures future broadband access for the communities of Yuzinki, just to the north of Kodiak Island, Chignik Lagoon, Chignik Lake, Cold Bay, and False Pass. Denise May is the tribal administrator for the village of Port Lyons.
It made so much sense for us to get this because there's already a project in the works.
GCI started laying fiber up the chain from Unalaska in early August as part of its Aleutian Fiber Project. The village of Larsen Bay on Kodiak Island was included in the company's initial plans to expand high-speed internet service as part of the undertaking. May says that plan made it easier for nearby villages like Port Lyons to get their own fiber hookups. She says many communities applied together as clusters so they'd have a better chance tapping into funding.
Individually, we're not enough because we're such small communities. But when we collaborate and there's more of us, it makes more sense to the government to put something in because then they know they're impacting so many more people.
It's hard to quantify just how big that impact will be, according to May. She's hoping that high-speed internet will reinvigorate the economy. Local businesses will have access to a larger market, and younger people will be able to work remotely. Connectivity will also improve residents' access to health care. It's opened a bigger and exciting conversation about the future, according to May.
Next is really rebuilding the community, right? What does our housing look like? What kind of jobs can we put into the community, encourage people to move home? It's a much larger project beyond the internet.
According to GCI, Unalaska homes and businesses will have high-speed internet by the end of this year. Residents in the villages on Kodiak Island will have to wait until 2024 for their new internet services to start. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. One long-term impact of the historic flooding that swallowed Hooper Bay last week is a dramatic loss of dunes. Those dunes form a natural seawall for the town, and without them, the town is exposed. KYUK's Will McCarthy went out with a middle school field trip to see how the coast has changed.
Let's go down over to that other dune over there.
On the beach in Hooper Bay, Daniel Cernick, a middle school science teacher, is working to wrangle a few dozen of his students. It's been less than a week since a powerful storm brought flooding and severe winds to the town of 1300. As part of his science class, Cernick wants his students to observe the coast and learn about erosion.
No, you need to think back before the storm. When you drove down the beach and you looked at the sand dunes that were like this, what was different between then and now?
The students are on the beach south of the village, where the storm surge was the strongest. The impacts of the storm on the coastline are all around the group. In parts of this area, what was once a stretch of rolling sand dunes is now a flat floodplain. There used to be five rows of dunes. Now, there's only one here. In other places, they remain intact. The beach itself has also shrunk. Before the storm, Cernick took measurements of how far the water was from the dunes. But with this field trip, he's trying to gauge how things have changed.
Yeah, they're going to spread out just a few feet apart on the new coastline. And then we're going to get the GPS data. They're going to record it on their paper. And then we're going to use that to build a map that's going to have the old coastline and the new coastline overlaid on each other.
According to Cernick's calculations, the storm eroded about 300 feet of coastline, bringing the water that much closer to town. The loss of Hooper Bay's dunes has potentially serious consequences. Hooper Bay has minimal ground above sea level. The dunes, for so long, have protected the village from high water. Here's Emma Smith, a longtime Hooper Bay resident. She drove her four-wheeler down to the beach after the storm to get a sense of the impact. I spoke to her in the Tribal Council building.
That was traumatizing just by seeing how much the coastline has eroded. There are not going to be enough protection for the village if water should be coming in from the Bering Sea. That's really scary.
A 2014 assessment by the state of Alaska estimated that the coastline near Hooper Bay erodes about 5 feet every year. Floods like this accelerate that timetable. The airport, which is only about a quarter mile from the shoreline, is the infrastructure that's most at risk of erosion over the next few decades. But more immediately, storm surges threaten the safety of the whole village. Although no one was injured or killed in the storm, the flood caused serious property damage and destroyed the homes of multiple families. Experts say these storms are becoming more frequent due to climate change. Tom Ravens, a professor at University of Alaska Anchorage and an expert in coastal erosion, said oceans can be an extremely destructive force.
And the way it works is, you think about a wave. Those waves are building over, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles. Those waves encapsulate just a ton of energy.
Ravens said Hooper Bay's dunes likely made the flooding less severe than it otherwise could have been.
The dunes can be considered like sacrificial elements. There's value in sort of rebuilding the dunes, even if the next storm is going to take them out. And the value is that they're preventing, to some extent, from the water from flowing from the ocean into the community.
Mary Hoschler, another lifelong resident of Hooper Bay, says she was already concerned about what erosion along the coastline meant for the village. With the loss of the dunes, it's hard for her to feel safe planning for her future here.
I think it's hard to think about, you know, I wanted my kids to live here. I wanted to build them a house and live in Hooper Bay, reside in Hooper Bay. But it feels like we have to move.
Back at the beach, students are laughing and enjoying being outside of the classroom on a brisk sunny day, rushing in and out of the waves. For them, at least right now, this moment is a learning experience and a chance to process the trauma of the past week. But for adults, it's hard not to wonder what the loss of Hooper Bay students will mean for these students' future and the future of the town. Here's Hoschler again.
I have no idea. It's just crazy and scary.
Reporting from Hooper Bay, I'm Will McCarthy.
People who left Castano Avenue in Juneau after Monday's landslide can return home, the city and borough of Juneau said yesterday afternoon. But they're asking everyone else to stay away for now. Tom Matisse, Juneau's emergency programs manager, said one home was completely destroyed by the slide and two more were damaged. Many homes on the street still don't have power, and there's no timeline for restoring it. Matisse said people will have to decide on their own when they feel safe to return.
We can't tell them when it's safe or when it's not safe, but with no rain over the last 12 hours, the hazard is definitely declining, and this hazard is a channelized, localized hazard.
Matisse said the city is still assessing whether it will need to do anything to stabilize the slide area. Taylor Sawson with the Red Cross said 12 people came to the emergency shelter after the landslide. They were given hotel vouchers for the night. For those wondering how to help, Sawson says there isn't much to be done right now. But she says the slide was a reminder that everyone should be ready to go in case of emergencies.
You know, it's really a good idea to make sure that you have an evacuation kit or an emergency kit somewhere in your home so that if you have to evacuate at a moment's notice, you're not, you know, spending those precious moments that you could be getting to safety, packing, you know, items that you may need.
The city says that debris removal could take several days. A former Alaska State Trooper has been named as the state's new lead on solving cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous people. State officials announced yesterday that Lonnie Piscoya started the job on September 19th, replacing Ann Sears, who retired last month. Piscoya is Inupiaq and was born and raised in Nome. He served in trooper posts spanning from Galena to Ketchikan, rising to lieutenant. Piscoya says he decided to come out of retirement when Public Safety Commissioner James Cockrell called and personally asked for his help on the state's Missing and Murdered Indigenous People initiative.
You know, there are quite a few of them that I had known or knew their last names because I'm an Alaska Native myself.
Piscoya says he started the new job by reviewing information from old cases. He has some specific goals.
That case is the goal to solve cases and get them through the adjudication process and find closure to, and give closure to some of these family members associated with that case. So that's the goal.
Piscoya says the state is planning to hire a tribal liaison and may eventually be able to fund a few more investigators to address the cases. Collecting meticulous data during a pandemic can help determine how diseases spread and how to stop them in the future. Reporter Sharon Lafreniere traveled to Alaska for a New York Times investigation that shows that COVID-19 data here and across the nation is lost or unusable due to underinvestment in public health. KTOO's Claire Stremple spoke with her.
What's the data failure and how did it happen?
We didn't spend money to modernize the state and local health departments. We left them with the spreadsheets, telephones, fax machines, Excel sheets, the old system. I think many people don't understand, and I certainly didn't understand until I got into this, how behind state and local health departments are in data. They're way behind.
You wrote that the low vaccine rate contributed to the heavy death toll in the United States from COVID-19, but so did the lack of data. Why is that deadly?
So, I mean, nobody can pinpoint, we lost XX million, you know, XX number of people, or so many other people, you know, were severely, became severely ill from COVID because we didn't have data. But basically what happened is that the fact that the data pipeline, if you think of the digital pipeline, is totally riddled with holes and obstacles and it doesn't flow, means that the government did not respond as quickly as it could have, because to some degree, you know, they were flying a little bit blind.
What made you come to Alaska to tell this story?
Two reasons. One, Alaska State Health Department is a pretty hard-charging health department, and it has a lot of talented people in it. Secondly, because its problems are quite typical.
What was the atmosphere like when you were here? You know, what did you see? Did anything kind of stand out to you while you were reporting?
People were in on the weekends working on data. They were working on it at night. They were, you know, coming in early, trying to make the data systems work better. I thought that it was a really talented and very dedicated staff just working on a shoestring, right? A lot of the case reports were coming in over the fax machine, which was on the fifth floor of the health department in the epidemiology section in a corner. And every night it would run out of paper, and they'd have to come in the morning, fill it up with more paper, then carry these stacks of case reports over to a computer to enter them all by hand. So it was a massive effort. It's just like the average health department, they don't have enough resources.
What are the consequences of using trained epidemiology staff to do a bunch of manual data entry? You know, what could they have been doing instead, and what did epi staff in Alaska have to say about this?
So, I mean, that to me was one of the more troubling things, is that if you, I mean, think of it like if your phone didn't sync with your computer, right, then you enter your information in the phone, you're going to enter it again in the computer. That's what was happening here. A whole bunch of people had to be roped in to re-enter information because the databases could not connect with each other. So the health department was forced to basically reduce some of its most highly trained epidemiologists for periods of time simply to enter data. And so they would do it on weekends, they would do it at nights, it would start at 6 a.m. in the morning, and that's not unusual. I mean, the disturbing thing about it is people put in all that effort, and then it really, a lot of it didn't come, wasn't useful.
In your reporting, do you or did anyone you spoke to have a sense of how we fix it?
You fix it by money. The government needs to spend, you know, billions of dollars for states and local health departments to upgrade their systems.
Thank you so much for taking time with me.
That was New York Times investigative reporter Sharon Lafreniere talking with KTOO's Claire Stremple.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
Read diverse, read indie on Insight Daily Radio, Conversations with today's most influential authors from the world of independent publishing. Shorn, Book 1 of the Sky Seeker series, is an intelligent and captivating new fantasy novel. Author Larissa N.N. Davila, also a child psychologist, tells a story of oppression and resilience, the high cost of vengeance, and the malleable nature of truth. Through vivid characters and a believable world, she explores the question, are we destined to identify ourselves by the scars others give us? We spoke with Davila about her new novel that Kirkus Reviews called a grand-scale fantasy with remarkable depth and characters that are emotionally relatable and endearing.
Where does Shorn fall on the genre spectrum? Shorn definitely would be classified by a majority of people as fantasy, probably epic fantasy. But a term that I really like to describe it is psychological fantasy, in that this is not the classic quest fantasy. This is not what some people would call high fantasy. Instead, it is exploring new worlds and exploring interesting situations, but in a very human way, looking at conflicts that are very, very human, no matter what the characters are.
That's author Larissa N.N. Davila on her new fantasy novel, Shorn, which is available wherever books are sold. Learn more about Shorn and the Sky Seeker series at stoneravenpress.com. Read Diverse, Read Indie is presented by the Independent Book Publishers Association.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 28th day of September, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 8:07. It will set again at 7:51. That will give us 11 hours and 43 minutes of daylight, a loss of 5 minutes, and I believe that is 4 minutes and 56 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 64 degrees set in 2015. Our record low is 30 degrees set in 1996, and it's currently 53 degrees. The winds have come down out at the airport. They are registering southeast 7 right now. They have 83% humidity, and they are back down to 5 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for more rain today, high near 56, southeast winds to 15, gusting to 20. Rain is likely tonight, at least until 11 p.m., then a chance of showers after that. Cloudy skies overnight with a low around 47, southeast winds to 15, gusting to 20. And for tomorrow, a 30% chance of showers, mostly cloudy skies, high near 55 tomorrow with west winds to 10, gusting to 30. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 4:02 this afternoon and be 9.5 feet. That will be followed by a low tide at 10:28 p.m. of minus 5/10. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 4:33 this afternoon. That will be a 15.4-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11 p.m. of minus 1.2 feet. Mariners, be aware. You have a gale warning today for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side. South 20, north of Dangerous Cape, though, southeast 40, diminishing to 20 this afternoon, seas to 16 feet today. For tonight, south 20, seas to 11 feet. And for tomorrow, on our east side, southwest 25, seas to 12 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning today. Southeast 35, diminishing to 15 this afternoon. Seas 9 feet, should come down to 6 feet this afternoon. For tonight, southeast 15, seas to 4 feet. And for tomorrow in the Shelikof, southwest 25, seas building to 8 feet in the afternoon. Thursday night, south 25, seas to 8 feet. There will be a celebration of life for Bill Harrington on Saturday. That's happening from 4 to 7 p.m. at Tony's. Everyone in the community is welcome to come. Please bring a potluck dish to share, an instrument to play if you feel like jamming, and your memories and good cheer. I'm looking forward to seeing you there, 4 to 7 p.m. at Tony's on Saturday. The Kodiak History Museum is launching a new lecture series called Lectures at KHM. The first one is coming up on Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. The lecture series will explore the work that KHM has done in the past year and significant events in Kodiak's history. The October 1st lecture will introduce our new temporary exhibit program. If you're interested in learning more about how you can be a part of the temporary exhibit, come to KHM on October 1st, that's this Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m., and learn more from the curator. The lecture is free with the cost of museum admission. Also on Saturday, the Humane Society of Kodiak's Walk Your Dog event is happening out at Kodiak College. That's going to happen at 10 a.m. Join in the fun for dogs and their humans. You can pre-register online or the day of the walk. If you want to pre-register online, go to their website at www.kodiakanimalshelter.org. You can also call Linda at 907-654-5717. And registration is $15. If you give them $30, you get a T-shirt. T-shirt pickup and day of registration begins at 9:30 a.m. That's happening at Kodiak College this Saturday. The Kodiak Amateur Radio Emergency Services Group will be offering amateur radio licensing exams on next Wednesday, 7 p.m. The exams will be held at the Bayside Volunteer Fire Department Training Room. Pre-registration is required, so please contact John Kimmel at 907-942-0741, and that testing is provided at no charge. Don't forget to early vote. The assembly chambers are open every weekday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for early voting, which is pretty much identical to voting on election day. And your early votes are counted in the unofficial tally on election night. So everyone is encouraged to take the opportunity to vote early if you're going by Borough Hill. Kodiak Borough meetings coming up include the Solid Waste Advisory Board. They are meeting at 6:30 p.m. tonight in the Assembly Chambers. Tomorrow, the Kodiak Fisheries Development Association is meeting in the Borough Conference Room starting at 9 a.m. Also tomorrow, the Assembly will be having a work session at 6:30 p.m. in the Assembly Chambers. The library's Halloween-themed escape rooms have already begun. They're running through October 26th. Gather a few friends to use logic, instinct, and detective skills to figure out the clues and escape from the room. Sessions are from Monday to Wednesday at 3:30 p.m., Tuesday and Wednesday at 5:30 p.m., and Friday and Saturday at 3 p.m. It's open to all ages, but children under 14 must be accompanied by an adult. Physical space is limited, so groups of four are recommended. Call the library at 486-8686 to reserve your spot. Don't forget that today's the day the library offers Lego Club. That happens at 3:30 p.m. at the library today. Children under 10 must be accompanied by an adult, but Lego time at the library, 3:30 this afternoon. Tomorrow at 10:30 a.m., the library hosts a Lapsit story time for babies 0 to 3 and their adults. Join volunteer Abby Hanna to share a story and a song with some quality time to play and socialize. That's 10:30 a.m. at the library tomorrow. And at 3 p.m. at the library tomorrow, the library's next chess club meeting. Drop in to learn, practice, or sharpen your chess skills in a cozy, friendly environment. No experience is necessary. It's open for all ages. Again, that's tomorrow at 3 p.m. The Kodiak Fish and Game Advisory Committee will be having their election and meeting Monday, October 10th, a week from this next Monday. That's happening over on Near Island in the ADF&G Chiniac Conference Room at the Fish and Game Building. It's to hold elections for expired and vacant seats. They're also going to discuss Board of Fisheries-specific COD proposals and other committee business. The meeting is open to the public, and residents of the area who attend the meeting and are of legal voting age may make nominations and vote. Again, that's happening at 5:30 p.m. Monday, October 10th, near Island.
KMXT is awaiting a new announcement from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game here in Kodiak. To hear the most recent announcement regarding openings and closures around Kodiak, call 486-4559.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.